The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and to my left is Tiziana, mom so hard subverse.
I'm interspecies momming today. We rescued a baby bird.
Oh.
Yeah. Went to like put it in a little, you know, cardboard box and call the wildlife people. So I nurtured it all evening, and this morning like scooped it out like friggin' Snow White, like carried it outside, you know, like Cinderella.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. Whenever I was little,
it ran away from me immediately.
We tried like we tried that and kept it in a box, and the next morning it was dead.
Oh golly. Yeah, we were worried about that because the two girls were like, Jubilee's 20 months old, she was like, baby.
Oh.
Yeah, it was really cute. But yeah, so that's how I'm mom so hard
there
today.
There you go. Behind the glass, yeah, is Rocket Man Andy Bishop.
I don't have any baby birds.
Yeah.
Not yet.
No, I have a lot of cats, though, so I'm not sure it's a recipe for success for when to show up here.
Yeah. So this episode is in regard to a previous episode that we did about contradictions, which I was not a part of. I wanted to be, but I couldn't be. Fortunately, my wife got a grant that night, which is awesome, and so we went to that instead. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hand this over to Tiziana, because Tiziana has invited a guest. I'd like you to introduce your guest and talk about how we're going to go back and kind of like relive that moment and maybe add to it and take away from it.
Exactly. Well, everybody, in the studio with us today is Dr. Eric Smith. He's a professor of New Testament studies at ILIF, School of Theology in Colorado. Eric, welcome.
Thanks.
It's so good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So I know Eric because I took two of your classes, I believe. I took Intro to New Testament and then another one.
Sure.
I can't remember. This is a couple years ago before I had to put everything on hold. But what happened is we had this whole episode back in May that was in reference to a TikTok Andy had sent that Dan McClellan had released. And so we had this whole conversation about it. And then, Rick, you texted me and you were like, I have some things I want to say about that. I'm sad I wasn't there. And I was like, well, let's revisit it. But this time, let's get like an expert, like somebody who actually is an expert. Instead of us, right?
Spent their life studying it versus being a layman like me.
Yeah, so if you missed that episode and you don't know what we're talking about, that's cool. But if you did listen to that episode, I would like to start this episode with a little segment I like to call Whoops.
I love it.
I've done this on the podcast before. I re-listened, so in prep for this, I re-listened to that episode. And as I was listening to it, I was like, nope. So what I did is I listened to the entire thing, and I'm literally opening up my notes because I want to talk about what I said wrong, because what I did say wrong are some things that we want to talk about today. So first off, you know, Ralph was leading that episode and he was talking about the Bible and when it was written, and it was written after Jesus. And I said all of it was written after Jesus, not some of it. I should have specified. I thought we were talking about the New Testament. So several times throughout the course of the episode, we're talking about the quote unquote Bible. And I thought we were talking about the New Testament. So I said things like, oh, there's about 5,700 manuscripts that we still have. That's not the whole Bible. I was talking about the New Testament, but I didn't specify that.
Yeah.
When we were talking about manuscripts, I was also dating them and talking about how old they are. And I was talking about the oldest piece we have, or the earliest, is from the book of John. And it's a little scrap the size of a credit card. But I said that John was on the front and there was a receipt on the back because people reused paper. People did reuse paper, but that was fragment P52 and it has John on both sides. So that was wrong too.
And just so you know, I listened to the episode, obviously not being there, and I assumed as well listening to it that you were talking about the New Testament. At no point did I think you were talking about the Old Testament.
Okay.
So you're good
there.
I didn't clarify all
that. But like, so I said that wrong about that particular fragment that we have. I don't know. Let's see what else. We started talking about pseudepigraphal writings. We started talking about the undisputed Pauline epistles, which is, that's what we're going to be kind of talking about today, is that. But I couldn't remember off the top of my head which books were undisputed and which books are, and I got it wrong. And Professor Smith, I'm going to raise my hand in class. Can you tell us what are the undisputed Pauline epistles and what are the ones we're curious about?
Yeah, there's really three categories. There's one category that has seven books in it that everyone sort of agrees, no one disputes, undisputed. Or sometimes they're called the authentic Pauline epistles, which is a very value-laden way to put it. But those are Romans, Galatians, Philemon, Philippians, let's see, 1 Thessalonians. What am I forgetting?
1 Corinthians.
1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians.
Yeah.
I think that's seven.
Yeah, that's it. And then I said Philemon was one of the disputed ones, and that was wrong.
Yeah, Philemon's actually an interesting case because Philemon is weird. Like, it's not written to a church community. It really raises the question of, like, why it's in the Bible, mm-hmm. which is an interesting thing to think about. There's two other categories. There's one kind of called the pseudo-Pauline or the pseudepigraphal or the disputed Pauline epistles. Those include Colossians, Ephesians, and 2 Thessalonians. And those are the ones that you can really find people on both sides who think, yes, this was written by Paul. No, it wasn't. And we could talk about what some of those reasons are. The third category is the pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. And those are the ones, really, unless you have kind of strong religious commitments to thinking Paul wrote everything that has his name on it, chances are the scholars don't think Paul wrote those. Now, there are some, even some very conservative Christians who would say something like, there are fragments of authentic Paul in those. But even some of those folks would only go that far. They wouldn't say that Paul wrote them.
Yeah. So that's kind of what sparked the conversation. During that podcast, I said that they were pseudepigraphal. I said pseudepigraphal writings were like normal in the ancient world. I didn't necessarily mean normal. I mean common. It's not like, you know, it's not like that's the only instance that we have of somebody forging someone's name. And we talked about this in a previous episode, but I want to say this now in front of Eric because I really don't want to have to come back and correct myself a second time. Also, my friggin' professor's sitting in front of me, so I'm going to be like very careful. So pseudepigrapha was not necessarily malicious. People would write things and sign someone else's name to it, like a young early writer, because not just in the Bible, but in ancient Greek culture, period, right? They would write a piece and they wanted it to get more circulated, so they would sign someone else's name to it so it would get more. Some people would do it in order to like show respect or honor to somebody. Sometimes they did it because they wanted to smash someone's reputation into the dirt. So they would like write something and be like, oh, so-and-so did it. But that's not, it wasn't necessarily malicious. And so it's not like whoever wrote 1 Timothy, if there's, you know, one of the things that Ralph, or I think it was either Billy or Ralph had said, maybe somebody else, like one of his secretaries wrote it, maybe he dictated it and wrote it, you know, and then I made a snarky comment that, yeah, but the Greek was dumber. That's not necessarily true either. That's not true. I think there are other books that are undisputed from Paul versus the squidgy ones where like sometimes the Greek isn't as eloquent, but Timothy's actually not one of them. So I said that wrong too. But, and I also said since Constantine made Christianity the state religion, he didn't make Christianity the state religion. That didn't happen until a little bit later. What I should have said and what I was trying to say is basically like decriminalized it and started making it be subsidized by the state and sort of like gave it permission to exist. Constantine actually retained his title as like head priestess of the pagan religion of Rome up until he died. So we're going to have a conversation about that later. Constantine wasn't like the hero of Christianity necessarily that we think because he didn't make it the state religion. That happened later. But I was like, no, there's no way that somebody was listening to Paul and wrote it down for him. Actually, I was wrong. That could have been the case.
Definitely was the case.
Yeah.
Definitely was the case. So I just wanted to clarify that too. It's not like pseudepigrapha is like, oh, it's cool.
Can he pick up about pseudepigrapha?
Yeah, and so that's where I'm going to end it.
Yeah, I would love to hear.
Yeah, so that's where I'm going to end it because I'm also like still kind of like in Tiziana did up mode.
Well, I can say that Andy loves pseudepigrapha.
That's my favorite part of the Bible.
He loves this part.
All the stuff they throw out is more interesting than the stuff they kept to me.
Right.
I know that's wild to say. I mean, Genesis aside, which is fascinating, But yeah, the suit of it's much more colorful. It's more interesting. It fills these weird plot holes that feel like they exist in the story. And the characters are more outlandish sometimes. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, we loved talking about like the life of Adam and Eve. And that was fun.
And the stuff that somebody once referred to me as a Bible fan fiction, which is a lot of like Catholic.
That was that TikTok lady.
Yeah, Bible.
That's right.
Yeah, I love Bible fan fiction. And that stuff's great. You know, stuff that came from Dante's Inferno, but people pretend somehow came from the Bible, stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, go on.
Well, that's what I was about to say. That's kind of how I frame it for my students often, is that we should think of this as fan fiction, that, you know, you've got someone like Paul or someone like Jesus who comes along, does a bunch of stuff, says a bunch of stuff, and then dies, and people come afterward. And in the same way that today we fill in the gaps in our canons, like Star Trek or Harry Potter or whatever, people were doing the same then. They were sort of being imaginative about this universe, the cinematic universe, you know, the Pauline cinematic universe, and filling in the gaps.
Now that's
and,
my favorite thing.
Yeah. So you can think of, you could think of the pseudepigraphal epistles that way, the pseudo-Pauline epistles. You could think of the book of Acts that way, right? That, which has some substantial differences with what Paul says about himself. And I think, you know, that might feel a little, transgressive for us to think about the Bible as any kind of fiction, but I think it helps us. It's a category that can kind of help us think about what they were up to. It was, as Tiziana was saying, it's a sort of pious category in a lot of ways. It's not done out of theft or duplicity. It's done out of a sense of honor and obligation and curiosity, I think. And, it wasn't transgressive in the ancient world at all. So fan fiction, I think, is a great way to think about it.
Well, and that's kind of what had come up. Also, when we talked about it, like if a book is pseudepigraphal, what's it doing in the canon because it's a lie? And it's not that black or white. And even if we take a step back from the Bible as something that's a spiritual text that we're all talking about, you know, it can, even if it was pseudepigraphal, it still gives us a glimpse into the life of the people at the time and like what they were going through and what they were experiencing. And it's not that you can't,
and such.
Yeah, it's not that you can't glean, you know, something for today from it, you know, but it is important to sort of think about it, that it, for me, especially when it comes to the ways that we create structures of power in the church based on things that were said because Paul said it. It's like, well, now hold on a second. If you are saying that this needs to be embedded in the structure of the church because Paul said it, Paul might not have said it, you know, so let's take a step back.
I was curious with what you said earlier, Professor Smith, it was in regard to Acts stating things that weren't necessarily Paul. Do you have any, like, off the top of your head examples?
Sure. Yeah. So just to kind of set the scene, so Paul writes all of his letters between about the year 49 and 60-ish or something, and Acts doesn't get written until, depends on who you ask, but between 70 and some people say as late as the early second century. So there's a little bit of a gap there already. But some of the things scholars point to, for example, are that in his letters, Paul is really clear that, hey, I'm the apostle to the Gentiles. I've been sent by God to the Gentiles to kind of loop them in on this thing that God is doing. Whereas in the book of Acts, Paul's modus operandi is always to go to a new place and go straight to the synagogue, preach in the synagogue until the Jews kick him out. Then and only then does he go to the Gentiles. So that's, you know, one good example of how that works, or a good example of the differences, I guess. The focus on his Judaism looks a little different, I think, in Acts and the letters, or at least in the way the Acts and the letters have been interpreted. So in the letters, Paul can be quite proud of being Jewish. He kind of goes on these resume rants where he'll just explain how,
like in Romans, he does that in Romans.
He does that a few places, right? Second Corinthians, there's this great passage where he kind of talks about how impressively persecuted he has been. But in Romans, he's like, I'm from the tribe of Benjamin.
I'm best Jew ever.
I'm the OG. Like you can't.
Yeah.
So he does that in Acts. There's three different places where it gets this experience on the road to Damascus gets narrated, and it's sort of, you know, in the text, it's sort of this way, but in the interpretation of Acts, it's very much this way, that it's a conversion, right? And scholars have more recently kind of rejected the notion that it's a conversion to Christianity, but it's easy to read it that way in Acts, whereas in the letters, there's not much sense that Paul has ever abandoned Judaism at all. So that's another kind of difference, I would say. There's a few others that we could talk about, but those are, I think, some of the big ones. The citizenship question in the book of Acts twice, Paul kind of makes an appeal to being a Roman citizen. And in the letters, he never does that, even though there's some places where it would have been handy to do so. Mm-hmm. So things like that. So people who study Paul through his letters often say you can't really rely on Acts too much, which again kind of raises the hackles of people who take the Bible very seriously, because it sounds like you're saying Acts is not telling the truth. Probably what's happening is Acts is written a generation later. It's doing the best it can, you know, based on the information it has, and it's telling a story that it wants us to be convinced of. It wants us to think that Paul is this important figure in this particular way, and so it's telling the story in that way to convince us of that, and that might be different from what Paul says about himself. In the same way, you know, Tiziana introduced me, I might introduce myself differently. Like we all look different when someone else is talking about us. So there's just some differences like that.
I was curious because, you know, for me, the issue with scholarship, which first of all, I'm thankful that we have scholars that spend as much time as they do to study this. I'm very thankful. So whenever someone makes the argument of, hey, this language, you know, the Greek had moved on a lot. You know how languages change. So the Greek had moved on. You know, by the time you get to the second century, they're not using Greek the same way that they're using it in the first century. So we see that in that writing. That's difficult for me to argue against because it's like, oh, well, obviously it's later, right? But when it comes down to the nuances of a person and the way that they act and it's being written by someone else, it gets a little sketchy for me because Paul himself is like the Jew of Jews. Like he's the Mac Daddy. And so for him, even to himself, he said, I'm guilty of none, right? But I consider it all dung. Like that's what the way that he looks at it. And then later on, he talks about, like, for example, the thorn in the flesh that he talks about. If you read it within its context, to me, I always interpreted that thorn in the flesh was his piety for Judaism. That's how the way I always sort of interpreted it. But that's just me. I'm not a scholar. I'm just reading it, you know, as it is. So whenever I hear scholars say things like, most of us agree that it was in after 70 or 100, I know scholars like Dr. Kenneth Gentry, who has spent a lifetime writing about why he believes that all of those letters were written prior to 70. Now, I couldn't argue against the languages. I how can you argue that, right?
People do.
Well, I mean, yeah. I can't. I don't have the authority to do such a thing. So I'm relying on scholars and other scholars that are arguing the point.
Yeah, and I would say, I think I'm agreeing with you here. I think it's definitely possible to give scholars, and I'm making air quotes with my fingers, scholars like—
You're good at podcasting. Good job, man.
It's definitely possible to give scholars the benefit of the doubt too much, right? And defer too much, because there's a lot of different ways to interpret literally everything. And there's, you know, categories of expertise, you know, that, oh, well, you go into a PhD or whatever, you have a tenure track job, therefore you must be correct all the time. That's not true, right? And the people who have those credentials and positions disagree with each other constantly, as you're kind of pointing out. So I think, you know, there's lots of different ways to know things. There's lots of different ways to know truth, and not all of them involve academic training or knowing ancient languages. And so I think, you know, that's part of what I would say about this conversation, is we all bring different kinds of knowledge, different kinds of truth to it. And we're never going to arrive at an absolute truth, I don't think, because it's not available to us. These people lived and died and wrote things down 2,000 years ago, and we don't have access to it. So we're
fragmentary pieces of history.
Yeah, we're piecing it together. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Carolina Cases. Whether near home, auto, suitcase, or hotel, you can be assured that with Carolina Cases, you can protect what matters most. Carolina Cases are TSA approved, so you know that your items are secure in a shock and impact-proof hard case. These lightweight, durable cases come with pre-cut, protective, high-quality foam to fit your pistol by make and model, compact size or full size. They come in a universal configuration for multiple options. Carolina Cases are more than a pistol case. They are available in fully customizable foam to protect what matters. You can go to their website at www.carolinacases.net to see their designative, protective lid designs. Each is laser engraved to give you unmatched style at home or on the range. So to protect what matters most, visit www.carolinacases.net. That's www.carolinacases.net. Enter code Burrows, That's Burroughs at checkout to receive free shipping. That's right. Just enter Burroughs at checkout and you'll receive free shipping.
Yeah. And so for me, like 4 years ago when we started this podcast, I started going through cognitive dissonance because I started reading the Bible just as it was anyway, and I realized, wait a minute, this doesn't fit with my fundamental teaching. I was raised in a very fundamentalist Baptist church where this is the Word of God in King James Version, dripped down from heaven to us. It's all authority and power. It is inerrant. Like, that's what I was taught the entirety of my life. So by the time I come into it and I start studying, I'm like, something's up. I started looking at, like, for example, the Septuagint. I love the Septuagint. I love to go and access the Septuagint. And you'll read the Septuagint, and it's almost like it doesn't even match my King James Version. There's so much. It's so rich. It's incredible. So that cognitive dissonance, and I want to tell the audience that are listening to this, who, especially like me, that grew up in a world where this is inerrant, everything is perfectly dripped from heaven into our English language, there's a lot of things that we can learn just from looking at the Greek itself and understand, like when we use the word agape, you know, agape is not the same as phileo, we know that, but when we read it in our English Bible, it simply says love. So when we do some extra research, that's why all of us in the fundamental world use Strong's Concordance. And even that's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can get in trouble with that. So
here's a good example of that. The Gospel of John, chapter 4, where Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman at the well. There's a place around verse 20, I think, I might be wrong on that, where all the second persons change from singular to plural. So it changes from you to you all or y'all. Mm-hmm. But in English, we don't do y'all, right? In proper English. So in your translation, it's going to say you, and you'll never know if you're just reading it in English that Jesus has stopped talking about the Samaritan woman and started talking about Samaritans. And mm-hmm. she has stopped talking about Jesus and started talking about the Jews. So that's one of those things that, like, yeah, knowing some of those languages can help you see that and help you understand something that you won't see in translation. However, I don't think it's, you know, a key to a secret realm of full knowledge either,
sure.
You know, as some people sometimes pretend like it is.
I would agree. And that's why I just wanted to state that sort of upfront here at the top of this podcast, that you might experience some cognitive dissonance from some of the things that Professor Smith's going to say, especially if you're questioning whether 2 Timothy is even written by Paul. And if you've always been, well, it's Paul. Well, if we're saying that it might not be, does that mean that it doesn't need to be in the canon? A lot of us don't even know how the canon was even made or constructed. So it's difficult at best. So as soon as you hear that, it sounds like an attack. This isn't an attack. We're just discussing this openly, and we're not trying to destroy your faith. We might be trying to say that women can speak about God in the public and that it's okay. That, you know, that could be possible for you. But and there are other areas in the Bible itself that state that women did this kind of thing. So you have to get, you know, you got to kind of come at this and just be open.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so for me as a, you know, cisgendered female, mm-hmm. right, I walk around in the world with a female body and a female, you know, presentation inside of a culture that has places for that. And they're usually not at the top of places of power.
True.
And so for me, I also was taught that the Bible was the inerrant word of God. I also was taught that every last word as it exists in the New King James Version or the NIV version, because I grew up Pentecostal Assemblies of God, so they were all about the NIV, that the way those things, you know, were written down, like that God inspired the translators to translate it into English exactly as he wanted it to be. But, you know, then those exact words and that exact translation were used to define for me what I wasn't allowed to do, where I was and wasn't allowed to go, who I was or wasn't allowed to teach or talk to. And so for me, when I learned that some of these things maybe didn't come directly from Paul, or one of the critical things that we talk about when we say what is Pauline and what isn't is also like theology. Because sometimes in a pseudepigraphal work or a pseudo-Pauline work, it will say something about what women can or can't do, or something that seems to be in line with, like, that this is Paul's theology, but it's completely different or it doesn't agree with something else that he'd said. And so for me, like recognizing that, and this is like, you know, this is one of the ones that gets me like thrown in the fire, right? For me, like recognizing that I can read the Bible, which I do. I can read it with Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior, which I do. I can receive spiritual you know, edification, which I do, but I can also look at certain things and go, ah, I don't think that's original. I don't think Paul said that, or I don't think that belongs there. It might've been added later, you know, to speak to a certain particular community, but it's not necessarily for me. And I now have permission to just be like, well, I don't, like, just to be fair, I don't even read First Timothy. Just for me, yeah. You know, because I'm like, there's too many things I don't know if that's correct or whatever.
I want to ask you, sorry, were you about to say something?
Go for it.
I want to ask you a direct question. Yeah. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Here's the hot seat. No, direct question. So would you say from the moment that you became a Christian to the time today that you have changed and matured?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that was an easy answer, right?
Sure.
Definitely. So I have always asked the question, is it fair for us to look at these documents that were written at a particular time, and they all weren't written at the same time by the same person, although there is a theory that somebody named Lucian did that. I don't know if you know about this theory. It's a very radical theory, but they believe he wrote all of the New Testament.
He lived on the edge of the flat earth.
Yeah, for like over 70 different, for 70 years. Careful now, like on the ice wall, like on the outside. Yeah,
because I mean, so, if there was gravity, you could just walk around the ice
there's
wall.
There's no that's such thing true. As gravity, according to them.
You can't
even pull that.
I don't even know.
And what I'm trying to say, we just about went way off here. So my thought, as I began to read the scriptures over the last 4 years, like I said, this has been a very intense time for me of study. And I began to see now that even the people that are within the Bible, let's use Peter as an example. From the time Peter is introduced to Jesus at the Sea of Galilee to the time that he writes the letter, if he wrote the letter, but let's say he wrote the letter, there's a massive change in his character and who he is. So what happens, the idea, what I've always been taught is that he wrote the letter just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem before his own crucifixion at the hands of Emperor Nero. That's what I was always taught, right? So that may or may not be true, but let's say that it is true. That way that that man is speaking is wholly different compared to what he was like when he was in the book of Acts talking about going to the Gentiles. You see what I mean? My only point is that when we're reading the Bible, you've got to give it time and space and growth, which means that Paul has time and space to grow. So what I use is like the book of Acts is sort of like a timeline guide based on that writing of Luke, if he wrote it, is that that's the timeline guide of how the early church was built. And from the time of Paul being on the road to Damascus to the end, wherever he's standing in front of like King Agrippa, he's an entirely different man. He's grown and changed within that. Yes, he receives direct revelation, but he's still battling himself all the time. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I place those letters that technically were written by him in those positions to kind of get an idea of how he grew in his faith, because all these men were growing in their faith. They weren't all like Christ. Christ had it. But even Christ grew in wisdom and stature, the Bible says. So that's the way that when I look at this and I hear scholars talk about it, and I always keep in mind there is room for error for human beings to grow. And he may have said this in chapter 2 and said something different in chapter 28 simply because of the growth of a person.
Well, that's definitely something that people argue, right? That the things I write when I'm 20 aren't the same things I write when I'm 50. And
sure.
that we should expect the same for someone like Paul. And you should expect his theology to change over time.
That is refreshing to know. I'm glad you said that.
Definitely. Lots of people, yeah. So one of the big, you heard me earlier say 1 Thessalonians is pretty much universally considered to be Paul, and 2 Thessalonians is disputed. One of the reasons is the eschatology, the sort of sense of what's going to happen with time, you know, is the world wrapping up or not, that changes between 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. In 1st Thessalonians, it's a real imminent eschatology, like any minute now, hang on you guys, it's coming. 2nd Thessalonians is more like, okay, we're in this for the long haul. And that's one of the reasons people say, well, he didn't write 2nd Thessalonians. Well, it's of course perfectly possible that Paul simply changed his mind as time passed and that he's saying something different in 2nd Thessalonians because he believes something different by the time he writes 2nd Thessalonians. It's also true that he writes all of these letters to different communities at different times. So this is kind of nuancing what you just said. All the letters are what we call occasional, not that he only writes them every once in a while, but he writes them for an occasion. He's not sitting down and writing an essay about everything he believes and knows. Instead, he's responding to certain things that he's been asked or things he's heard about. And so we sort of rely on the occasion of writing something like First Thessalonians or the occasion of a letter like Romans without knowing fully what it is and without knowing exactly what it is Paul's responding to. So I think that also nuances, you know, the differences across the letters is he might be saying things in one letter that he says differently in another because he's got a different context to respond to in a different moment in that community's life.
Sure. And which also makes like, so it kind of takes me back to my own, like my personal walk, my own personal faith, right? Where there were certain aspects of my life that were important to me whenever I was a father and had children at home. You know what your life was like pre-children, what life is like post-children at this stage. I know what it's like to have children at all of those stages and grown. As a matter of fact, I just became a grandfather again. Last night, Jacob had his baby, little Bo.
Oh, congratulations.
I'm super excited. I can't wait to go see this youngster. But so now what I'm doing is I'm observing Jacob become a father. I remember what that was like for me whenever Catherine was born. And I was like, oh, I know that feeling. I remember that feeling. I could see it in his face. I can hear it in his voice. It's a whole newness to him. He's got this. So like you said, he's talking to a community. Say Paul, he's talking to Thessalonians. If you read the book, you become very aware that there's a lot of extreme persecution that's happening to that particular church at that particular time. And he's letting them know, guess what? Your suffering is going to come to an end very soon. Keep the faith. Keep pushing. By the time you get to 2 Thessalonians, we really don't know exactly what's going on, but he's sort of like reinforcing that to continue to be that, because the Thessalonian church was supposedly the church that everyone should look to because of how they lived, right? So you said that 1 Thessalonians is considered a Pauline letter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if let's take that one and say, okay, so Paul actually did go to Thessalonica. He did meet with them. He knows the truth. Later on, after he leaves, he writes a letter and sends it back to them. He hears around the world in which he lives what's going on to the Thessalonians, and he's telling them this. But as time goes on, there's something else to be said to that particular community that doesn't necessarily translate into Corinth. Corinth isn't dealing with the same thing that the Thessalonians are. So we just kind of like pick up these little fragmentary ideas of doctrine from this. But it doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be rock solid at this very moment. There's plenty of churches today that believe that all of this is still future, and there's some churches that don't. Some of them think that part of it's future. So anyway, I guess my point is that I like the fact that he said that Professor Smith said that scholars consider that when they think about it, because that makes me feel better, because I experience that myself. I grow, I learn, and I say different things. I'm going to tell Jacob a lot of things about being a young father that I was never told because I learned it. And so, he even watched me grow up because I had children very young, right? I was only 20 when Catherine was born. So 21. So to be able to look at him and say at a 23-year-old, this is what I've learned. And now I'm showing you as a man, kind of like 2 Peter is telling you, hey, you know, come and get the, you have this like faith, you have these precious promises, hang on, make your calling and election sure. All the things that he's saying, he never would have said when he was sitting there talking to Cornelius. That's not even a part of his mind. He's not even thinking that. This is the first time he's ever even spoke to a Gentile in this way because of a vision that he saw. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I really spoke a long time about that, but I know people that listen to our podcast and I know what they're thinking because they've told me so. And so I just want them to understand, yeah, there's room, okay? There's room for us to talk, but that doesn't mean we need to negate scholarship. These people are brilliant and they've spent a lot of time at this. Let's listen and see if we can learn something from them.
So can I plug a book while we're on this? I think it nuances it even more. This is a book that just came out by Candida Moss, who's a very well-known New Testament scholar. And the book, I think, is called God's Ghostwriters, which is a very kind of provocative title. But her argument in that book is she's taking something that we've already actually kind of gestured toward in this conversation, but that scholars have known for a long time, which is that a lot of the New Testament was written down by scribes. So not, you know, Paul doesn't sit down with a pen and papyrus. Paul sits down and dictates letters. And you know this because at the end, sometimes he'll say, I think, is it Galatians 6:11? It's something 6:11.
Yeah.
Where he's like, look at, I'm writing this like last reading in my own hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Romans, there's a thing that says, I, Tertius, greet you in the Lord or something like that. So Tertius is the scribe. Candida Moss is pointing out that the way scribal practice worked in the ancient world, these people are enslaved. These are not like Paul's buddy, Tertius. This is Tertius, who is owned by someone who is doing this kind of work. It was a very specialized kind of labor. And she's kind of pointing out that, you know, if we're thinking about authorship and we're thinking about authority in the New Testament especially, then we have to take account of the fact that these things, these letters, these gospels probably, a lot of the texts of the New Testament are mediated through the minds and the hands of enslaved people, and that they have a share in the authorship. And we know in some cases, you know, it'll say, we say these are Paul's letters, but they're not Paul's letters. Some of them are Paul and Timothy. Some of them are Paul and Silvanus, right? That they're co-authored. And it says that right up front in the first few verses. She's arguing like some of these people might have been enslaved. Some of the letter carriers, someone like Philemon, you know, might have been, not Philemon, Onesimus.
The slave who
carries the letter back to Philemon, was enslaved. Someone like Phoebe maybe even might have been enslaved. And that we have to take account of that when we're asking these questions about consistency, change over time, authorship, like whose voice are we hearing? How much liberty did an enslaved person have if someone's dictating? Do you paraphrase when you write it down? Do you add your own thoughts? That's a big question. And so this is a great new book on that subject that I think would probably be interesting to a lot of people.
Oh, I'm getting that book for sure. Since this is going to be on the Burrows, I'll try to find a link and put it there for you guys if you want to go look at it. That's a wonderful thought, you know, that, you know, with Philemon, you know, Paul is making it very clear, like, look, Philemon, you kind of owe me, like, I'm not holding it over your head.
I'm not going to say you owe me my life, yeah, your life, but you know.
But by just saying that, now you get it. And so, and Onesimus is carrying this letter back, and it's kind of a really, it's an amazing thought, because we all want to be like, no, the Bible, you know, the slavery. There's a lot of people that get upset about slavery. Slavery was a part of their economy. That's just the way it worked back then. You know, well, God should have ended it. All right. Well, there's slavery today. I mean, God should have ended that too, if we want to go that far, but we should end child trafficking and everything else. We're all trying. If you want to blame God, then that's your prerogative, I suppose. Go for it. But every society has had this in it, all of them. And some of it was far worse than the way we describe it. Paul himself, you know, dictating to Epaphroditus, does Epaphroditus have the right to say, because he knows Paul, he just like, maybe he puts a few things that Paul just said, you know, Paul's said, hey, I wrote this in my own hand. And then he walks away. And then he's like, and after that, he's like, oh yeah. And then please be sure to say hi to such and such and such and such. That could be directly from that scribe. I don't have a problem with that at all. Like, I don't, fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't necessarily change the way that I interpret and read the scripture. And by the way, according to history, from what I understand, the church, like these Pauline letters, they think there were 12 to 13 with Hebrews being considered one of them, but I don't think it is. But to walk around, they were carrying these letters around, and we know that they were circulating them from church to church. That's true. So from that point, that person that's carrying it, who knows? I mean, I don't know, but they accepted it. The churches accepted it back then. So I'm okay with that. I don't have a problem with that at all.
Unless it's telling you that you're not allowed to talk.
Right. And that, again. Which,
that's, and those are the things, I'm totally with you, I'm hanging with you on all this. And I love this idea, too, that, like, these pieces of art, or these pieces of, you know, the words of God or whatever, are more than just Paul. There's, you know, these other people whose life and whose significance and whose lived experience might be finding their way into these texts. I think that's beautiful. And I love thinking about the text that way. And there are also ways that these texts have been used to create power structures of subjugation. And those are the things that I think need to be reckoned with. And we need to talk about those things in terms of, well, now then who did put that in there? You know, that's where we come with redaction and with interpolation, which is, you know, looking at multiple copies that we have of a certain thing and noticing that they don't line up exactly. So where did which one was the right one? And did something get added? Now that's a different thing than what we're talking about now. But that sort of naturally leads into that for me, because I'm the one who, you know, my embodied experience, I'm the one who's gonna experience subjugation based on what some of these things say.
But now let's just talk about us personally. Have I ever tried to silence you?
Absolutely not.
And you know that I read my Bible thoroughly.
I know.
Okay, yeah. So let's put two things juxtaposed against one another. Paul teaches a lesson that there is now neither male nor female, bond nor free, Jew nor Gentile. He uses that in his sermon. Now there's neither male nor female, but he tells Timothy in a letter that he supposedly didn't write, that I suffer not a woman to teach. I don't allow a woman to teach.
Yeah, and in 1 Corinthians, a woman's not allowed to speak.
Right. So there's this idea. So how can there be no male or female, yet I suffer not a woman to teach a man? So it's obvious to me, the way that I interpret it, just me, whether it's he wrote it or not, the way I put it together and interpret it, and tell me, Professor Smith, if you think that I'm crazy, to me it seems like it's poignant at a particular place to a particular community for a reason. And it would almost be like him saying, I'm not adding words. I'm just saying, I don't allow a woman to teach a man there because. So we know that there were women, historically speaking, like in the city of Corinth at this temple that were very, very loud. That's historical. But I don't know. The Bible doesn't actually say that, right? So to me, it seems like I don't see you as a woman of the faith. I see you as in the faith. That's how I see it. So I let women teach all the time. By the way, I do take a lot of heat. There's a lot of people that are so fundamental that I'm wrong, but I'm sorry, I'm not wrong. There's neither male nor female. I disagree with you 100% based on the way that he describes us in the kingdom, the end. That's how I see it. Am I wrong?
Well, I think it's a complicated story.
Bust my chops.
No, I think
we like it.
Yeah.
So I think it's a complicated story, and it has to do with what we think we're doing when we read the Bible.
Okay. Right?
And so we've been talking about kind of where the Bible comes from, but there's also the other side of it, which is we have this document from the ancient world that a lot of us think is bound up with the divine in some way, mediated by that it mediates the divine. So what do we do with that? Are we free to interpret it, and to what degree? So 1 Corinthians does say women should stay silent a couple chapters away from where it talks about what they should wear while they're praying and prophesying, right? So it's clearly not a definitive voice about the role of women, even leaving aside all the, like, did it get dropped in by a scribe later kind of questions. Like, it's contradicting itself within a couple chapters of, it's chapters 11 and 14 in 1 Corinthians that these two contradictory statements kind of show up. So what do we do with that? What do we do with this ambiguity, I guess, if you want to call it that? And so different traditions have treated it differently over the years. And I think, you know, the traditions I belong to a couple generations ago said that women are full equal partners in ministry. And over those couple generations, it's gone fine. We're doing great. God hasn't hit us with lightning or anything.
That's nice.
I mean, and it turns out that, you know, it's better than fine, that it creates a church that is doing the work that it's supposed to be doing in some ways better than it was before.
I'm going to give you an amen on that one. 100%. Yeah. I've seen it myself. I've watched it. Look how we've grown in here.
Well, and you talked about how you put females in leadership at your jobs. And you watched everything
all
change.
Of our leaders are females. Yeah. I mean, all of them.
You know what
and
else?
They're better suited for it. They're incredible.
Even if you want to say the early church didn't have women in leadership, they also didn't have podcasting equipment. They also didn't have smartphones that you could listen to podcasts on. Like, we do lots of stuff, right, that they didn't do in the first century. And I think it's perfectly fine for us to do those things. You know, we don't have to be bound by first century gender roles or any, you know, technology or cosmology. We don't, you know, they lived in the first century. We live in the 21st century. And I think it's fine for us to acknowledge that and act that way.
It's a dumb quip, but I like to say, if God had a wanted man to fly, he'd have taught him how to make a plane.
Which technically he did.
Got around to it eventually.
Yeah. So with what you just said about those two contradictions, now, of course, here comes the fundamentalist. No, it's not. Okay. My point, what I'm about to say is this. To look at them as contradictory, yes, 100%. They do. When you look at them, you're like, but then again, when he's writing the letter and what's going on in the church, it does allow us to sort of elevate above it and try to see what is the problem. Like, why did he say it this way? And I like to give it that part too. I'm okay with it. If you want to say it's contradictory, great. I'll walk away. It's fine. It's contradictory. But I also like to engage in it and say, why? Why is it contradictory? What is the difference here? And what, it's not necessarily a change of mind, or maybe it is, or it's a change of person. And maybe it is. There's the scribe popping in. But like you just said, it may not be that. So what's happening? So do we want to look at that example or no? I mean, I don't. We could do this probably 1,000 times. We don't need to do that. I'm just saying to engage it and see if you can reconcile it.
Yeah.
Well, that particular example is one of the places, even though earlier on I said you don't have to always trust what scholars say, that's one of the places where scholars are pretty sure what happened, which is that there was a marginal note. Just this is the way manuscripts worked, right? Like you hand copy manuscripts. Then let's say I'm sitting there with my copy and I write into the margin a note. We've probably all done this in our Bibles. Like we put little notes in there and then someone comes along and they have a choice to make when they're copying it again for the next time. Is that something that got left out and someone added to the margin because they realized it belonged? Or is that someone's note to themselves? And the scribes had to make that choice all the time. More often than not, it's something that got left out and it got written in the margin to make sure it was preserved. That's what they thought. They put it in there. That's the thing that says, as in all the churches, women should stay silent, yada, yada. And so now it's in some of our manuscripts. It's not in the oldest manuscripts. It's not in all the manuscripts, but it's in some of them. And so in most modern translations, it'll show up in parentheses or brackets or something. And there'll be a big note at the bottom that says the best manuscripts don't have this. So in that case, the one that says women should stay silent is pretty universally considered to be a later edition. There are other places in the same letter, right, that are less than ideal for Paul's perspective on women. And I think if you had gone to Paul and asked him, let's say we get a time machine, we go back and say, hey, Paul, what do you think about women? He would have answered like a first century person. Like he wasn't some leading edge feminist or something. He's a first century person. But if we're relying on what the text says to us, I think that's a case where it's pretty clear that that's a later fragment that got dropped into the text, maybe accidentally over time.
Well, I mean, and it's obvious. I mean, and I would say that Paul and Peter and anyone else would have answered like a first century person because they lived in the first century and the things that they thought were going to become imminent were in fact imminent to them because their entire world was completely destroyed by 70 AD with the Romans. So that ended. So whatever imminence that they may have been feeling or what's going on, that would be true. And maybe because of the hierarchy of the church in its time of what it's, you know, what's going on there. Yeah. Maybe the woman shouldn't be speaking at that time because they have no power or authority whatsoever. But post that time, as the kingdom continues to grow, male nor female takes precedence because that imminency is over. That part of it is over. Am I crazy?
Yeah, no, I don't think you're crazy. The thing you keep quoting.
There's one guy.
I'll stay quiet.
One vote in your column. Okay. Abstention over there. So the thing you keep quoting, the male or female piece.
Yes.
A lot of scholars think that that was actually a baptismal creed, that what Paul's doing there is citing a little bit of liturgy that, you know, let's say you go get baptized, you come up out of the water. And that's what you would say. That's what the community says is like, look, in baptism, all these distinctions are erased. So in some ways, it wasn't a reflection of what Paul thought was true in the world at that moment. It was an aspirational or it was a forward-looking kind of thing to saying, here's how it ought to be. That, you know, it ought to be that once we're in Christ, a new creation, then all these distinctions and all these differences and slave and free and all those kind of things get erased, which I think is quite beautiful.
I do too.
And I believe it to be true. I believe that it's true. And I believe that post that time, because of its timing, I don't know. I'm big on timing. You know, I think that it's important. I think that the Bible writers made sure that we knew that timing mattered. And so I think post all of that, as you're in the kingdom, that is the way that it is. We're looking at with a microscope and a fine-tooth comb going through these writings from a specific time period in a specific region. Really, in comparison to the rest of the world, it's a very, very small region, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, I think it's just that. So I'm having a moment over here because the fact that, like, it makes me want to cry when I think about how many women have been subjugated, how many women have been harmed, how many women have had to force themselves to be in a position that they really don't want to be in or that they're not comfortable in because of this verse that now universally, I want to say that again, almost universally, scholars are like, that's probably not how that happened. That verse isn't in our oldest versions of this particular piece. That really just like strikes my heart. And I'm curious. This is something that I was talking to my husband about last night. And he was like, don't say that.
Oh boy.
I know, which means I'm going to say it. But again, because I don't believe that I'm only allowed to say what my husband has told me I'm allowed to say.
Right.
I'm not only allowed to go where my husband says I'm allowed to go or own what my husband already owns. I don't believe that, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious what would happen, because one of the things Ralph said on the episode that we were still referencing is like, why aren't we adding more books to the Bible? Why is the Bible like stuck where it is and that's where it is? And I made this whole big, you know, long rant about because of power and the Catholic Church. And if you can control what people read and tell them they can only read this, then you control people, right? But I'm so curious why, when we have, I mean, when they translated to the King James Version, right, they didn't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. They didn't have what was in the caves at Nag Hammadi. We have those now. So I'm really curious why there's not been more effort, like you said, Eric, that they put that in parentheses now. Why there hasn't been more effort to recognize that if it doesn't belong, why are it's still being used as an excuse to structure power in churches?
So there's a lot to say here.
Yeah.
One of which is Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls are different things.
Thank God. See?
Nag Hammadi is a town in Egypt where they excavated some books that are called the Nag Hammadi Codices.
There we go.
In this episode mm-hmm. that we're talking about, you talked a lot about codices. So the Dead Sea Scrolls were found at Qumran.
Qumran, that's right. Yeah. That's where I get it mixed up in my brain. Thank you.
You can buy lots of Bibles that will actually kind of in the notes tell you, okay, here's what the Dead Sea Scrolls say, and here's actually the Dead Sea Scrolls might have 12 different readings. And the Nag Hammadi codices are non-canonical works. So they're not, you know, copies of the Gospel of Matthew or something. They're different kinds of books that are fun to talk about, but not necessarily in the Bible. The question of the canon, I think, you know, I'm on the left side of Christianity. I'm on a progressive Christian side of things. And in my neck of the woods, often we're very conspiratorial about the canon. Like people are like, oh, it was a back room filled with cigar smoke and people were, you know, doing deals on what got into the Bible, that kind of thing. Constantine fixed it all or something. No. What happened with the canon is it coalesced, it crystallized over a long, long period of time. And you talked about this some in that episode, right? That it had to do with what was beloved by the people who were in community with each other. The word that Eusebius, who's a church historian, Eusebius doesn't even really use the word canon. He uses this other word that means something like encovenanted or beloved, right? Mm. They're things that really are meaningful. So what ends up in our canon is a product of that, you know, and they weren't sitting down and saying, okay, did these things contradict each other or not? Because they weren't, that's not the question they were asking. That's a question we ask of the text that I don't think anybody much asked before now. Look at the book of Genesis, right? Like it's got different creation stories right next to each other. Didn't bother anybody till the Enlightenment. And now suddenly it really bothers us.
This episode is brought to you by Carolina Cases. Whether in your home, auto, suitcase, or hotel room, you can be assured that with Carolina Cases, you can protect what matters most. Carolina Cases are TSA approved, so you know your items are secured in a shock and impact-proof hard case. These lightweight, durable cases come with pre-cut, protective, high-quality foam to fit your pistols by make and model, compact size, or full size. They also come in a universal configuration for multiple options. Carolina Cases are more than a pistol case. They are available in fully customizable foam to protect what matters. You can go to their website at www.carolinacases.net to see their designer protective lid designs. Each is laser engraved to give you unmatched style at home or on the range. So protect what matters most. Visit www.carolinacases.net. That's www.carolinacases.net. Enter code Burrows at checkout to receive free shipping. That's right. Just enter the code Burrows at checkout and you'll receive free shipping.
So I think with canon, the question of do we open it and add things to it is interesting. The Protestant canon arguably got set in about 1523 when Martin Luther did his translation into German. That's when kind of the modern order of everything got set. The Catholic canon a little bit before that at the Council of Toledo, I think I have that right. I might be wrong on that. We might need a fact check later on this episode. But so it's fairly recently, you know, we think of the canon as having been set in a dark back room at some point a long time ago, but it really wasn't. It was set pretty recently. And the question of whether we could add things to it is an interesting one. I doubt it's going to happen, mm-hmm. but I do believe that inspiration and revelation are ongoing. I don't think it all happened 2,000 years ago. So at the very least, I think we should be open to that and watching for it and expecting that God is still trying to tell us things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I remember, like you said, when he first started telling us, there are several Bibles that are out there. I'll never forget the first time I got the Bible and it said that John chapter 8, what talks about the woman caught in the act of adultery, wasn't even in the earliest manuscripts. And I was like, bummer.
Sometimes
like
it's
that, I know, makes I me love so that sad. One.
But yeah. So it's obviously one of those marginal things that made it into a later edition or whatever. And I, you know, should I keep it or should I not? Because the early editions didn't have it. I don't care. Like, I'm not even going to go there. I love that part of the story. I think it's something that Jesus would have done, and I'm good with it. But there are several things in the Bible, like you said for yourself, that why is it still there? Why are we saying it? Well, those Bibles do talk about that. They say some of them weren't in the earliest parts, or they'll have somebody. And we do add to canon. We just don't realize that we do it, okay? For example, you can have a church that loves to read The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. And they could be talking about it 30 years from the time that he wrote it. It's a part of that church and that community, and they think and act accordingly.
All right.
It happens, okay? So that's what we discover that in here is that the way the groups work, you know, the communities that you're in, a lot of these communities adopt particular traditions and ideas, and then they go with it. So not everybody's perfectly running around, you know, like a first century Jew converted Christianity. It's not happening, you know? So, I mean, I think that it's, you need to surround yourself, which you have, with people that are like-minded in regard to this. They, first of all, you can hang around with me anytime you want and say whatever you want, whenever you want, and it's totally fine. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But one of the biggest arguments that happens in this room, especially like between me and Andy, always in, you know, not really Jess, but we kind of go back and forth is, if you need this thing to be perfectly inerrant, dripped out of heaven in order to follow it, you're going to have a hard time doing it.
Yeah.
You just are. You're going to spend a lot of your time wrestling with this.
Yeah, that's the thing I've been saying lately. It just seems like if your faith is built on a absolutely perfectly true and unerring, uncontradictory Bible, you're not far from an existential crisis at any moment in your life.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a house of cards.
And so that community, Andy, that community, which I grew up in, see the Bible as the inerrant word of God, and that's the way in which they treat it, and that's the way in which they live. However, and I'm going to really piss some people off, you don't really do it, and you don't really live according to it. Nice try.
I mean, it's almost impossible,
nice
right?
Try. You don't.
Yeah.
Let's just be real. You don't. We're all just going through life to the best of our ability. Today, I'm not going to read Titus. I'm going to go see my son because he just had a grandson, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing today. But everybody that comes to this, if you're going to drive yourself nuts, if that's what you want to do, is you're the kind of person that has to drive yourself nuts with an inerrancy, then have at it. But I'm not going to partake with it. I'm not going to play. I'm not going to play that game.
Can I suggest one more book?
Yeah, please do.
On this topic, I think it's one of the best books
Sounds
written
like
in the last few years.
You need to write a book, sir.
I've written a few.
Oh!
But
we need to post that.
I'm kind of tired of it at this point. I've written four. But this one is by a scholar named Angela Parker. She's on the faculty at McAfee School of Theology at Mercer University in Georgia. And she has a book called If God Still Breathes, Why Can't I? And it's a wonderful book written in the pandemic, written in the middle of the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's about biblical authority. And it's asking just these questions of like, how do you sort through, as someone, she's from the Baptist tradition, like, how do you sort through these questions of interpretation? How do you confront the text where it's saying something harmful, right? Or perpetuates harmful things, where it's trying to stifle your voice? And it's just a wonderful book. I have my students in my New Testament intro class read that book now, and they love it. So If God Still Breathes, Why Can't I? Check that one out.
Angela Parker.
And she'd be worth having on the podcast
sometime.
I'm going
to get that one. That one sounds really good. That sounds right up my alley.
These two people that you've talked about with these written these books, do you know them both?
I do.
Maybe we could try to get like an introduction to them and maybe have them on and talk about their work?
Yeah, definitely.
That would be incredible. I'm sure that'll be on notes.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't have to be. You know, Notes from the Underground doesn't have to be like the place where we all go for our, you know, controversial and contraband Christianity, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
But I mean, it often is. Well, it's because I'm already a woman teaching and preaching on my own podcast.
How dare
so
you?
So I'm already controversial. Like, I'm already contraband. So, you know, I guess that's the place to do it.
How much time do we have? It's 11:30. How much time do we have you for?
I got nowhere to be.
Okay, so we're 6 p.m. Good. All right, I'm just kidding. So go ahead. Sorry, Tizian. I just wanted to make sure.
No, really,
we
like
still
that's it. Like that's all I'm saying. And so you know, I mean, and again, like that's one of the things that happens for me. Like you have the girls' corner and you have like the boys' corner, and you know, in the girls' corner, the girls are talking about girl things and things that pertain to girls, and in the boys' corner, they're talking about things that pertain to the whole wide world. Yeah. And that's one of the problems and one of the challenges that I find as an individual human being walking around on the planet. So I've got Notes Through Me Underground. It's a separate podcast that's affiliated with Burrows of Bria. Rick's actually my co-host over there. Mm-hmm. And I tend to discuss these other things, contraband things, like we, you know, right now we're doing a study on astrology in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And today, as a Christian, you know, if you know your sign, are you disobeying God in some way, right?
Right, right.
But that doesn't have to be like, it tends to be like, oh, if the girls are talking about it, then that's for the girls. And I really don't know how to defeat that necessarily, because I mean, I'm happy to have these scholars on my show, especially if God still breathes, why can't I? And then I get afraid that I'm doing that same thing. I'm just having the girls in the girls' corner talking about the girls while the men are in the men's corner talking about the whole wide world.
Yeah, but see, you're gonna have different groups. You're gonna have men, groups of men that argue with men that just in their interpretation of the Bible alone. For example, Andy loves Dan McClellan.
I love Dan McClellan.
And just so I can do a fun little plug.
Yeah.
He's coming here in studio September the 14th.
I cannot.
And that is my gift. That is my gift to you too, yeah. Andy and Tiziana, because you guys are constantly bringing that dude into my face.
I know.
So I sent him a little message and I was like, hey man, I've been introduced to you constantly by our atheist on the podcast. Do you want to come? And he said yes. And so he is going to come. I'm super excited to have him here.
That's scary for me though, because I have to like, that puts me in this weird position where I like want to try to come up with a topic that's already interesting, you know?
I think that man's fascinating. I love watching him talk, but I don't have anything to add to that conversation. It's too far for me. He knows so much more than I do.
However.
Eric, do you know Dan McClellan?
I don't.
Okay. Oh, he's a TikTok star when it comes to this stuff.
He's kind of a popularizer of, you know.
He's a biblical scholar.
He's the one that got this whole conversation started for us, because Andy sent it to us. And Andy likes to send us TikToks occasionally like that. And I'll say this to you, Andy, just like you said to me about having Bart Ehrman on the show. You may not have anything to add, but you definitely have a position. So being able, but I agree with you. There are certain things that I can't elevate to Bart Ehrman.
Sure.
I can't. I'd love to have Bart Ehrman and Dan McClellan in the same room, though. Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah. People, yeah. Yeah. Anybody with like a PhD. You just got to be like, all right.
I know a lot of people with PhDs. I don't know about anybody with a PhD.
Okay. Okay. Fair.
Shade.
That's really good.
Yeah. Well, you know, and... Yeah, so Eric and everyone else that's listening, Dan McClellan is a biblical scholar. His podcast is called Data Over Dogma. And what he likes to do is he likes to take popular things that are being espoused by, and generally it's generally fundamentalist Christianity. And he's always careful in his TikToks to be like, don't attack this creator. Please do not give this guy a hard time or gal a hard time. But what he generally does is he takes what people are saying. For example, my favorite one was when this fella starts talking about Easter and the history of Easter and where it comes from is Babylonian. He pops in and he's like, absolutely not true. This is where that actually comes from. And like when people are posting a picture and they're like, this is a picture of this historical place. You'd be like, nope, it's actually this. Because this whole thing is data over dogma. And like, let's ask ourselves what this is really all about, you know? And he's really funny and scary. I like live in fear.
He treats everything kind of like he's peer reviewing it.
Yeah.
Not like he's,
yeah,
right. He kind of like, yeah, he addresses, he's just flat. He's just like, okay, so this is absolutely not what that man said. This is actually this. We see this here and here. And he's just flat. He's like peer reviewing TikTok.
Yeah. He's doing data over dogma.
Yeah,
Simply data over dogma. It's a great title for a podcast.
Yeah.
So
oh my God.
You
Can
cover?
You imagine if he'd been sitting here and I was doing the Nag Hammadi Qumran caves? Lord of mercy.
I often wonder, because the breadth of the, he's a New Testament scholar, but the breadth of those TikToks is so large that I believe he must occasionally have to actually do new but small research for those things.
Dan McClellan's just a New Testament scholar?
As far as I know. I mean, that's not, I mean, that's his specialty. He's a
Yeah. He talks more about the New Testament. But what he was talking that day was about the Old Testament.
Right.
He was actually focusing on how God changes over time in the Old Testament. Yeah. That's what he was really after. And how different authors were interpreting him differently.
To me, it's as simple as the fact that God consistently refers to themselves in the third person, us, or a plural, in the plural. Yeah, like we, us, and then all of a sudden it's I, like...
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure Dan McClellan did a TikTok on
he
how
did.
That's
He called
not
it a, the yeah. divine counsel and all this other oh, stuff, yeah. but you know, yeah, which I think is interesting. Right. And I have to go look at that TikTok, but I mean, like for me, it's like that in itself kind of should show to even the most inexperienced of us that something shifted over time, that language shifted too.
Just
right?
like people shifted.
Either the people changed their views of God or God changed their view of themselves. I mean, I or don't know. Maybe God got on some medication and no longer has schizophrenia. Yeah, I don't know.
The situation that the community in causes them to change their ideas about what they think that God is doing. I mean,
yeah.
it's crazy how this works. And none of us have the finger on the pulse of all of it. I think all of us have a piece of the puzzle, but not all of us have the entirety of the puzzle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, and I think sometimes we ask questions of the Bible it doesn't want to answer. We want certainty from it. We want consistency. We want, you know, God to use the same language all the way through. We want Paul to be the same all the way through. And that doesn't seem to trouble the Bible. It doesn't seem to have troubled the people who put it together.
Great point.
You know, that's and a so great point. It's an anxiety that belongs to us, I think, and not to the Bible itself.
And that's one of the things that, so in Eric's class, I read two books that I recommend everybody read, Justo Gonzalez, A History of Christianity, Volumes 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. I'd read almost those entire things in a semester. Thank you very much.
Like 3,000 pages.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, Lord.
And I was taking it at the same time as like, you know, Dr. De La Torre's class on ethics, and he's got you reading like an entire book a week. You know what I'm saying? Like my husband was just like, I hate when you're in school. I was like, yeah. But it's a really good book. And that I remember reading that exact sentence that the four Gospels, they were never supposed to be the same. There's differences in them that the people who put them in there. Yeah. And we have this obsession now with synchronizing the Gospels and making them the same. And there's no contradictions, especially like, for example, in the resurrection story. Like there are some pretty distinct and significant differences in like what happened after Jesus was resurrected, who was present when Jesus was resurrected, you know, all this other stuff. There are different versions. And we spend all this time trying to make them harmonize when they aren't supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and that was something that like that just like blew my ever-loving mind when I read that.
Yep.
One of the things I did a sermon at Berean Bible Church. I can't remember. It's been a couple months ago. And one of the things that I was talking about was from what I read from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it was a temple scroll that the Essenes had written. And within that temple scroll, in section 46 and 47 of that temple scroll, it goes into detail talking about these three specific villages that were to the east of Jerusalem that were used as like hospital villages. And that what they would do is that they would take care, and it was Dr. Brian Capper from Christ Church University in England who wrote this, and he actually put it into an encyclopedia of the Bible and its reception. That was the name, that's what the work was for. So it's a scholarly level document, and he's talking about how that in these three villages, it was Bethany, Bethphage, and En-Shemesh. Well, we know Bethany and Bethphage show up in the Gospels, and so that was kind of interesting. But this temple scroll talks about this one village that is used, for example, like taking care of lepers. And we all know, because of the Essenes and what we know about them, is that they were considered the children of light. They were a non-marrying group. And what I was trying to do was show, and I have a reason for saying this, what I was trying to do was showing them, the congregation, that if what is said about Bethany is true, that those people that were from Bethany in the Gospels, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, how they were, none of them were married, and how interesting it was because when that Christ would come to that place, that rather than thinking that Mary was rich because she had that ointment of spikenard that was worth a year's wages, that in fact it didn't belong to her at all, and it aligns better with what Jesus says when he says, leave her alone. She has taken this and used it for me and my burial. Let her keep it for that reason, and that from now on she'll be remembered by it. That in fact, Jesus was in a hospital village. And it's really interesting because that same woman, Mary, later on, she will go and anoint the feet of Jesus with that spikenard, and he's in the home of Simon the leper. So I'd read some scholarly, you know, things about that, and Brian Capper says it's really simple. He's in a leper community, and the house of Simon the leper is one of these places where they're taking care of lepers, and you would think, well, you can't be around leprosy because it's unclean. Well, they weren't priests. They weren't working in the temple at the time. My whole point is this. I used the Dead Sea Scrolls to back interpret what I was reading in the Gospels. See what I'm saying? The
extra biblical sources to make the biblical make sense.
And then it actually opened up the story and made it more beautiful to me. I saw that the place that Christ ascends in that same book is the place where these sick people are.
I cried when I listened to that episode.
Did
by
you?
The way. Yeah. I thought that episode was just beautiful. Your sermon was beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you. So, but again, what my point is that I'm using the Dead Sea Scrolls and people who have studied it. And by the way, not all of them are fully translated yet. I think there's still some sections that are left. So we don't even know what's out there. Yes, I'm using them because they're actually from the time. I mean, we're talking about being in these caves shortly right before the destruction, of the last ditch effort, I think by 73 AD, when they were wiped out by the Romans. I mean, you have to understand that the Romans like obliterated this entire culture. They were done with it. So they just obliterated it. So by 73 AD, the thought is that the Essenes and everybody had been wiped out or at least pushed out. And there was another dispersion of them throughout. They were not allowed to be there. So taking that extra biblical source and doing some research and then going back and looking at those letters, even if whether they were written by the person or not, it can help you. It can help you sort of develop like, this is an interesting take on it. And it's no different than somebody that's not using in all those sources and think that the Bible is inerrant trying to teach you something. It's no different. Yeah. To me, I think it's better. I like to do that extra research.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. Are all hearts and minds clear? There are no contradictions in the Bible and it's totally inerrant. Is that what we said here?
I think so. That's what I got out of it.
The minutes back.
So, Professor Smith, would you please tell us where we can find some of your work, whether it be your books or a blog or whatever? Tell us about it.
Possibly a Discord.
Yeah.
I don't have my kids have Discord and I don't understand it.
Yes, my nephews do too. It's wild.
But you can find me on Substack at ericcsmith.substack.com. I have a blog there called A Lover's Quarrel, where I talk about the lectionary text or the readings, the weekly readings from the Bible for the churches that use those. And I have a few books out, but probably the one listeners would be most interested in based on this conversation is one called Paul the Progressive with a question mark after it, where I sort of go through some of these big questions of like the one we've been asking about, like, hey, was Paul a misogynist?
Yeah.
And or is he an anti-Semite or is he a slavery apologist? And I kind of work through Paul's letters in asking those kind of questions.
Okay. Are those links on your Substack to your books?
They are not. That they should be probably
in the show notes.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be sure to put that in the, if you guys go back and you look at where you clicked on this episode, there will be a paragraph. And at the bottom of that paragraph, I will have a link to Professor Smith's information so that you can get to it. And also, I'll try to remember that link to, would you help remind me of the two books? We had Angela Parker's book.
Yep. If God Still Breathes, Why Can't I? And we had Candida Moss's book, God's Ghostwriters.
Okay. I'm going to try to find that for you guys and put that there so you can link and take a look at it. I'm definitely going to get those books. I want to read it. That's exciting. Professor Smith, would you ever consider coming back?
Yeah. I come to this part of the world all the time. My mother lives here. My brother lives here. A bunch of friends. And I like the restaurants, as Tiziana knows. Mm-hmm. So I'm here all the time. Just hit me up.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I'd love to have you back. And and thank you for introducing us, Tiziana.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad. I'm especially glad that it gave me the opportunity to go back to my own self and be like, wait, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Which, again, I do often do on this show. But like, I was like, oh, God, what did I say?
Yeah. So would it be, is now a good time to give you a joke?
Oh, yeah. Sounds like it.
All right.
This is for Professor Smith. You ready? What is a scholar's favorite nut?
I don't know.
A macadamia nut. Academia.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Academia nut.
Donut.
That was horrible.
That is a joke.
I liked it.
That is a joke.
Smoked. Bam. I love it. Well, Tiziana, thanks so much for introducing him. And Professor Smith, thank you so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
This has been great. I really appreciate your time. Andy, you had to be here, and I'm glad that you are.
Oh, thank you.
And Tiziana, keep momming so hard.
It's good to be here.
I'm glad
to take a break from it and be here.
I hope that bird is alive.
I know. I'll go check when I get home.
Baby birds are a high.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. Anyway, well, thanks to you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will talk to you guys again next time on the Burrows of Berea. Peace out.
Bye.
Hey, guys, this is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. A lot of people have been asking us, hey, what is this Patreon thing? Our old Patreon ad didn't work very well. So here you go, guys. Go to www.patreon. That is patreon.com. Let me do that again. patreon.com/theburrowsofberea. If you go to the Patreon page, you will find that we have different levels that you can give at. We have a $3 level, a $5 level. We've got a $10 level and a $20 level. I thought about putting a $1,000 level there, but you never know how that's going to work out, right, Andy? That's right. So go to www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea and give us all of your money.
Even a little bit, we'll be fine.
Yeah. And that $5,000 wouldn't hurt my
ego. No, it would hurt nobody.
Thanks, guys.
I forgot he said Substack. For some reason in my head, it was Discord. So I was like,
oh,
trying to make a joke.
I don't know anything about Discord.
Like, yeah. It was like, I don't have a Discord. That's not what I said. And I was like, oh shit.
I said nephews, and I actually have, they're my cousins. These kids are teenagers and they're on the Discord and they're constantly fighting and debating about different biblical things. And they've never stepped foot in a church. And I've asked them a question and they've never read the Bible. And I'm like, guys, how are you on there arguing the Bible when you've never even read it? So somebody will say something. Yeah. They'll grab their Bible and they'll quickly read it. And they'll be like, no, this is what it's, you know, they don't even know what it means. But my aunt, it's her sons. She has told me on numerous occasions, I'm going to destroy this house if I hear them complaining. Like, they're in there debating, and they're yelling and screaming at, you know, at their laptops. Anyway, good stuff. All right. Well, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. I've had my own podcast for all of 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
you've been on a podcast for quite some
time. Well, I've been on it. Yeah. But I've been here. I've been on Burrows, but I haven't, you know what I mean? Like, I haven't even like had my own thing.
Administrative duties? That's the word.
What?
I'm trying to say administrative, which is not a word, but I was trying to make it one, but I can't quite find it.
Administrist? I don't think of it like administrist.
Like
administration?
Administration.
Administrative?
Yeah, I was doing a wrong thing with it on purpose, but I couldn't land
it. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was like, that could be a word, but no, it's not. We're rolling.
We're rolling.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody be quiet. What? We're rolling.
Yeah. Are you leading the episode or am I leading the episode? You are.
Isn't this yours?
Yeah, I think that's yours.
I thought this was for Burrows because we talked about this.
Oh, okay.
Well, then Burrows. I'll do
it. Yeah.
But I'm going to put it on mine too.
Okay.
If that's cool.
Yeah, because we are going to talk about what's happening with this episode.
Well, and this whole thing came about because of an episode that came out on the Burrows in May.
That's right. Okay, so this is
mine. So I figured, this one was yours.
Got it.
Okay.
All right.